Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from. A curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. No matter how much you choose to give, you'll feel awesome next time you tune in, knowing that we wouldn't be here without you. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Plus, we have great member swag. Show off your HRN pride with a t-shirt or keep your hands safe in the kitchen with an HRN potholder. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Andrew, what are you doing?
That's my special report music.
Oh, my God.
Wait. Does that sound terrible?
I'm just so happy you didn't ask me to do that this week.
Would you have done it? You
wouldn't
have
done it. No, I totally would not have done that.
This is a special report.
What is it? Is this breaking news?
It's not. Well, it's not breaking news, but we don't have special report theme music here at Heritage. So
you're improvising.
I'm improvising. I'm making lemonade out of lemons.
All right, I like it. So what's the big story?
It's not a huge story, but it's a huge guest. I think it's a huge guest. Curtis Stone was in town, or is in town briefly. We're here on Monday morning. He flew in Sunday and literally came right to his hotel room where his communications person, Gita, I'm going to horribly butcher your last name, McCutcheon. I hope I didn't ruin that, Gita. Because the schedule was so tight, Gita and I were already there, set up to tape a podcast. He came in, he put his bag down, he took off his coat, he sat down, and we spent an hour recording, and then I came back up here to Hastings. But Curtis has this wonderful restaurant called Maud. He has another wonderful restaurant called Gwen, which is in Hollywood. Maud is his first LA restaurant in Beverly Hills, and it, for years, was a restaurant that changed monthly the menu based around a single ingredient. They would create a tasty menu based around a single ingredient. I was there earlier this year. I had the beet menu. Some people don't like beets. I love beets.
You love beets, and you also loved that meal.
That
I remember
meal was
you calling
amazing.
Me.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. The meal was amazing. The service was amazing. The selection of plateware and tabletop stuff. I mean, it was just gorgeous. Everything was really thoughtful and terrific. And they've been doing this for almost 4 years, and they are now changing it up. They're now going to change the menu quarterly, and they are going to do a menu based around a single wine region. So the first one is Rioja, and Curtis and some key team members went to Spain earlier this year to do some tasting and inspiration getting. And they're in the midst of getting the menu ready. It debuts late January, so a little more than a month from now. And Curtis wanted to come on and talk about you know, the reasons for this and how they've gone about it and this exciting time in the restaurant. And how do you say no to that? So that's why this is a special report. Last week I said we had maxed out our season. That's why we did a twofer last week, because the maximum number of episodes this season at Heritage is 14. But we're shoehorning this episode in. It should drop later today, Monday. And then this Wednesday, we're going to have the what was going to be our last episode and still will be chronologically of the season with Richard Blaze, who was highly entertaining. And that'll be the actual last episode that airs.
This is a fun week.
It's a fun week.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
is Curtis excited?
Curtis is, you'll hear it. He's, I think, very excited. And for people who only know Curtis from television, I think it's really important to say that he's probably known to most people in this country, certainly, from his television work, which there's been a ton of. Mm-hmm. But Curtis was born in Australia, went to London as a young man, mm-hmm. worked for the legendary chef Marco Pierre-White, rose up through that organization at Marco's flagship three-star Michelin restaurant, was the opening chef at Quo Vadis, which was a Italian restaurant that Marco opened in London. So Curtis has serious chops. I mean, I know a lot of people, and I'd say that I'm definitely one of them, who believe that if Michelin Guide were still in Los Angeles, that certainly Maud would be a two Michelin star restaurant and probably a decent chance that Gwen would be a one or two Michelin star restaurant as well. I mean, that's how good the food is. So I think when Curtis announced a few years ago that he was going to be opening this restaurant in Beverly Hills and it was a tasting menu and the ambition of it, I think a lot of people who only knew him from television were thinking, what, that guy? He's going to do that? Like, what's he thinking? And they just had no idea of his background, which is really substantial. So I should say, I probably would have done a more biographical interview, but just a little more than a year ago, when Gwen opened, which is his meat-centric restaurant and butcher shop, which recently shifted from a tasting menu format only to a choice between a tasting menu and an a la carte menu, Jimmy Bradley and I had him by telephone on the Front Burner. And that is episode 21 of the Front Burner. If anybody wants to go to the Heritage webpage or go to iTunes or Stitcher and look up The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, which doesn't exist anymore. We're not doing new shows, but it's still cataloged there. There's a really great, about 30-minute interview with Curtis the day after Gwen opened, which was really terrific and gives you a real sense of his biography. He's just a smart, thoughtful, talented chef. I was thrilled that he made time in his never-ending, never-stop-moving schedule.
That guy's so busy.
He's so busy. He reminds me of our friend Marcus Samuelson, we were saying a few weeks ago. I don't know. I really don't. There are moments where I think, has cloning technology gotten further than we realize?
No, you talk to a lot of people like this. Michael White, same
thing. Yeah, Michael's the same way. But anyway, Curtis, thank you for making the time. Everybody who's listening, here you go. I hope you enjoy it. This is my interview with Chef Curtis Stone, recorded this Sunday, December 10th, at his hotel in New York City. Please enjoy. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. You are fresh off the plane.
I am. Happy to be in New York. I haven't got to New York as much this year, but I'm happy to be here.
No? You feel like you're here all the time.
Yeah, it comes and goes for me. Sometimes I'm here a lot, but yeah. Not as much this year.
Okay. Before we get into restaurant stuff, I'm curious, you coming from Australia.
Yep.
This time of year, we just had I saw on your Instagram as you were flying in, you said you had a picture of the city over the wing of your plane and said it looked like it was dusted with powdered sugar.
Right.
So this for me, I grew up in Florida. You live in LA.
Yep.
But I come from a warm weather climate. You come from Australia.
Right.
Where it's basically summertime at the holidays.
It is.
What for you feels like Christmas? Does the place you just left, Los Angeles, at this point in your life feel appropriate at this time of year because you grew up that way? Or when you come to a place like this that's sort of covered in snow,
the way we all see it in the movies and
right.
other cultural events. Does this feel like Christmas to you? What's your touchstone at this point?
So I first moved to London when I was like 21.
Uh-huh.
And I can remember getting to London and, you know, experiencing a cold Christmas. It wasn't snowing, but it was very cold.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is it. This is why. This is why he wears a big red jacket. And this is why there's snowing every, you know, like I just, as an Aussie in the middle of summer, we eat oysters as our appetizer for Christmas Day. And
For real?
Yeah. I was just back there last year, and after lunch, I took the boys to the beach, and we had a swim in the beach lunch. And
no, I grew up in Florida,
right?
And people think I'm joking when I say this, but more Christmases than not, I went to the beach.
Right. Well, I mean, why not?
Why not?
It's a beautiful day, and you got the day off. So, it feels much more Christmassy, if that's a thing, when you're in a colder climate.
It does to you.
Yeah, I felt that. I really loved it in England for the 10 years I was there. And then, you know, now obviously LA is probably more like Australia than it is, you know, the East Coast of America at least, weather-wise. And, you know, it's interesting. We're going to Mammoth this year. So we're chasing the cold for Christmas. Uh-huh.
Nice. That's great.
Yeah.
So let's get right to why we're here this particular week, why we wedged this visit into your short trip to New York.
Yep.
Maud Restaurant is undergoing a transformation.
Right.
Why don't you say it in your words? What has it been up to this point?
So we started off with a single ingredient at the center of the menu. We change the menu each month. So that one ingredient has been sort of the focal point of the degustation each month. And, you know, I was trying to think of what to do when I did a restaurant. You know, you have all these ideas about restaurants your whole life. And in some ways, Maud was the restaurant I dreamt about my whole life. And then in other ways, you know, it needs to make sense for LA, right? And the diners out there. And when you're in LA, you hear so much about the diners. They're all vegetarian or they're all on a diet or a special diet, and it changes each month.
High maintenance,
yeah. You know. And, you know, the thing that I really fell in love with in LA was the farmers markets and how special the ingredients were. So I thought if the restaurant, because I always wanted to do a little restaurant that was a tasty menu only, and I thought maybe if it focuses on a particular ingredient each month and you do like a 10-course tasting menu, then that keeps me and the cooks in the kitchen on our toes, trying to like come up with the dishes and, you know, try and flip it all over each month. And I wanted it to be a challenge. So that's sort of what it began as, you know, one ingredient, degustation, 10-12 courses each menu, depends on the menu, but the price fluctuates, so it goes up and down. So, you know, we've just finished a white truffle menu at $375 per person, but we've also done you know, a carrot menu at $80 a person. So it's sort of my idea there was, you know, the broke culinary industry could come in, because we are all broke at some point in our lives as cooks and waiters, and we could come in and still experience it on a cheaper month, but then we could also make a bit of money on some other months to even things out. So that was the idea, and we're 4 years in. It's been great.
Amazing.
We're really happy with it. And
can I before we get into the new the new incarnation, right? And I don't want to dwell too much on the past, but before you say goodbye to the concept as it existed, what were some for you of the most successful menus that you did? Are there ones that you look at and just think, man, we just nailed it?
Yeah, it's interesting, because there's a couple of things that stood out. The things that you absolutely love, you tend to do a really good job of, because you get really excited about it. And then there's certain ingredients, so we've since learned, that make it quite difficult to do a 10-course degustation and escape a flavor component, like sweetness, for instance. So corn was a really difficult menu, because everything was sweet and we didn't want it to, you know, it's hard to eat 10 sweet dishes of one after the other.
Probably easier in the dessert.
Yes, very easy in
and
the
more
dessert.
And more difficult.
Yeah. So we found the acidic,
the savory, yeah.
Right. The acidic stuff worked better, you know, like passion fruit, for instance, which is super bright and sort of acidic, but still kind of floral. And you can take that in so many directions, where with sweetness, if you start with sweetness, it's kind of in some ways harder, which I never realized that until we did this project. So, some of my favorite menus were passion fruit, which happens to be one of my favorite ingredients. The truffle menus are really special to me, because you never really get to just go wild like that with truffles like we did. We did some crazy stuff with truffles that you would never even attempt to do normally.
Like what?
We juiced them, we deep fried them. We did all sorts of stuff that you would just, you know, we had to, because you're like, well, we got to find some diversity through the menu. And we cooked white truffles. You normally never cook with white truffles, but we just sort of played around with it to try and find some variation. And another menu that I really loved was morels, which was early on. That was a really beautiful ingredient, because you could do so many things with it. You could draw funkiness out of it. You could keep freshness in it when you cook it fresh. You could dehydrate it. So yeah, it was cool.
That's great. Okay. So what's happening now?
So we sort of, you know, I guess before you get tired of something, this is my theory anyway, once you're tired of something, it's too late. You know, it's very hard to put the pieces back together. So as soon as you start to feel like, okay, what's next year's ingredients?
Yeah.
As soon as that comes into your mind and it's not a joy, it's kind of a chore.
Yeah.
I sort of feel like the fatigue starting to creep in. So we said, let's flip it around. And we've always done a pairing with the dishes. So the wine geeks in the restaurant will come in and sort of put together an incredible pairing with the dishes. So we sort of, because that's been such a feature of the restaurant, I sort of wanted to evolve that a little. And sometimes we've gotten to the place where I'm like, you choose a wine and I'll do a dish for it, which is the opposite to how you normally do it. You normally cook a dish and you say, okay, find a wine that works with that.
Yeah.
And we've been doing that a bit more over the last couple of years. So I sort of thought maybe replacing the ingredient with a wine region could be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually traveling to the wine regions. We're starting with Rioja.
Yeah.
And we take the team over there and we sort of search for inspiration in the same way we used to go to a farm and explore corn, right? And you sort of say, all right, well, what can you do with corn that's more interesting than what's so obvious? And so we did that. We go, we drink wine, we look at architecture, we listen to music, we go out and get drunk with the locals. We, you know, we try and absorb as much as we can culturally from the region and then do a menu in its honor.
So let's rewind just slightly. Can you go in, blow out this trip? When did you take this research trip that you took? And who is the team?
So we were in Rioja for the first one, and the restaurant was still open, obviously. So we had to go with a pretty skinny team, but Gita and I, who Gita works with me across both the restaurants, more from a marketing perspective, Justin Hilbert, who's the executive chef down there, Ben Aviram, who's the sort of head of the wine team.
Okay.
And the general manager, he's our head of operations. Really. He started as the general manager.
He has a beard.
Yes.
Yeah. I've met Ben. Yeah.
Yep. So it was just the three of us and Gita on this trip. And then on the next one we'll do in January during the closure. So there'll be about six of us going, mostly from the wine team, actually. In some ways it's the wine team now have a really challenging job, because they have to create a pairing from a region rather than a pairing from the entire world. So we're sort of, you know, we're digging for inspiration down there.
So now they're going to get to have the challenge with wine that you all had with corn or truffles or
exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. We've reversed the treadmill. Now they're on it. We're standing back.
But tell me about this trip, because you know it's funny. Last week I had Michael White was on the show, and we were talking about how chefs love to travel and to take inspiration from their travels, right?
Yep.
Sometimes it's the conversation we had was that oftentimes it's not as direct or as literal as what you're talking about with Maud, right? Like oftentimes the comment I made last week was every chef I know, they have 4 days off, they're going somewhere.
Right.
And it seems to recharge them, it seems to give them ideas. Oftentimes you can't even put words to why it is. It's just you come back with new ideas and perspective and excitement. And this obviously, there's a very direct correlation to the menu.
Right.
So can you just tell me a little bit, how long was the trip you took to Rioja? And what were you all doing? Were you going to vineyards? Were you eating at a range of different types of restaurants? What kind of what was the trip like?
So we went for just under a week, which is a quick trip, you know, when you're trying to when you're working, but you can imagine how much we slammed into it. We visited a variety of wineries and sort of got to know the winemakers and some of the owners of the wineries and vineyards and asked them a bunch of questions about the history of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And we also met with some chefs, you know, a couple of 2 Michelin star chefs that we hung out with, and we went mushroom foraging with. We went
with the chefs.
Yeah, yeah. Ate in their restaurants. Mm-hmm. We cooked in their restaurants. We went to, you know, we did a little stage. Both Justin and I did a stage in a restaurant, which was kind of fun. Yeah.
Which restaurant?
We were up at Alameda. Francis, the chef, spent some time with us, and he actually took us foraging that morning.
Yeah.
And, you know, even just learning his story was a source of inspiration. You know, this guy works in his restaurant, which was his mum was the chef of that restaurant, Alameda, and before that his grandmother was the chef. So he's like, you know, this is and I think maybe even his grandmother's mother. So, you know, he was like, it's 4 generations chefs, and I'm the first guy, you know, so there's a lot of weight on my shoulders to do a good job. So, you know, it was sort of, it was fascinating sort of just understanding, you know, in Spain in general, but especially in Rioja, it's super steeped in tradition, and it's very old school in its way of thinking. But there's this real new way of thinking there as well. You know, it's sort of the old and the new really clash in a beautiful way. You know, we went to Riscal, this beautiful old winery that's been around for 100 years, and Frank Gehry did the architecture in the new building there. And you look around and you're like, there's this building that looks like it should be downtown LA, or, you know, in one of the centers of the world. It's just out in the countryside amongst some vines, and their way of thinking is really quite abstract and almost it's almost like they've got something to prove. You know, I think
that's interesting. I have to be honest, and it kills me because it's the only language I speak. Having grown up in Florida, I learned how to speak Spanish as a kid.
Right.
I think about, you mentioned the architecture, I think about Spanish art. I think about a tennis player like Rafael Nadal.
Yeah.
Spain seems very adventurous to me.
It is.
For all the tradition, the word I always think of is adventurous. It seems like there is a real kind of throw caution to the wind approach to anything expressive.
Yep. Totally. In a bizarre way, it sort of reminded me a little of Australia. I've always sort of described Australia as being in some way a little anti-authoritarian and a little rebellious and, you know, we're a young country, but we're still a penal colony of Britain. That's still our official status. And, in some way we don't kind of like that, but we still are kind of loyalists and monarchists, you know, and it's this interesting dynamic. And I found that in Spain too. You know, I think there might be just a slight chip on some of those winemakers' shoulder about Rioja not getting the notoriety Burgundy or Bordeaux or some of these other fabulous wine regions from around the world. So they do things their own way, and they are very proud of that, which I think is really cool.
That's great.
Yeah.
So what, as you're going to having these experiences, was it sort of, let's just be here, be in the moment, have this week or so, maybe a little less, and then process it, go back, we'll talk about it when we get home? Or was there sort of a constant kind of dialogue amongst you guys as you're over there? Ideas about wine, ideas about food, ideas about a wine and food that complement each other. What was that process like?
It was fun, actually. It was really fun. It's like being a big kid again, and you just get to play, and you've sort of got this freedom and this white space to really dive in and dig deep. And that day we went mushroom foraging with Francis. I said to Justin, I'm going to go with him. Justin actually ran off to a chorizo factory, and he went and made chorizo in the morning, and I met Francis, and he came up to meet us afterwards, and he showed up and didn't see us straight away, and he knew what we were there to do, and he sort of started finding mushrooms himself, and he pulled his jacket off, and he's pulling all these mushrooms out of the ground, and then he came over and found us, and he literally was freezing cold with a jacket full of mushrooms. And, you know, it's I've never seen him actually that happy. You know, he almost skipped. I was like, look at you, you're having a good time. And he's like, this is just amazing. You know, we found some other cool stuff, you know, little herbs and flowers and stuff that were just native up there growing. And we went back into his kitchen and we cooked with Francis, and he did a dish and Justin did a dish. And we all sort of, you know, it is a really inspirational thing. We went up the day before and we met this couple that have some goats and milk the goats and make this goat's cheese. And you're just up in this like unbelievable countryside that you just can't imagine, where the air's so fresh.
Yeah.
And it was really quite cold and just so damp and wet and green. And you know, there's this old guy who we met, and his job was looking after the goats, and then his wife's job was to make the goat's cheese. And damn, this goat's cheese was just so good, you know. Yeah. We made the cheese with her, and we understood how she did it. And I said to Justin afterwards, it's like then we got into a conversation with him actually, and they're telling us about their daughter, and they said, you know, she's gone to Madrid to study law,
yeah,
and it's just such a shame. You know, can you imagine she's going to be in Madrid doing law when she could be here with the goats and take this over from us? And they were just so – they just couldn't understand why you would want to be a lawyer in a big city when you could live in the mountains and milk
keep
goats.
Keep it simple. Yeah.
I kind of agree with them. You know, it was pretty beautiful to sort of – to understand that attitude and then see the product that comes out of this little goat cheesery. It was really fun.
Now, that's the kind of experience, right, that is as literal as your goal is, that something about that will find its way into the tone – of the menu that you guys do,
yep,
but you won't be able to pinpoint exactly what it is, right? There'll be something about moments like that.
Sure.
That'll inform in some way what's between the lines, to put it in writing terms,
yep,
of the menu.
Yes.
Correct?
It's the intangible that's always so interesting.
Yeah,
you know,
the poetry of it, the magic of it. Those moments are important. You wouldn't be able to watch a YouTube video about this farm,
right,
and do the menu that you guys are in the process of creating.
No way. You know, I tried to leave on the Sunday and I got in the car. We had this fabulous lunch and, you know, we went to this great restaurant and they slow cooked all this beautiful stuff in a wood fire. And the restaurant was packed in the middle of the afternoon. And then I set off for Madrid and I was sort of driving, and I'd been driving 20 minutes. And I thought, God, I hope I see a gas station soon. I'm nearly out of gas. And, you know, I sort of turn another corner and then finally there's one and I drive up and it's closed.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know everything shuts on Sunday on a in Spain, but I didn't realize the gas stations were included in that.
Yeah.
And I literally drove past four closed gas stations till I got to a motorway, and it worked out okay. I found one on a bigger motorway that was a 24-hour gas station. But there's even something in that I love, that it's so steeped in tradition, and it's almost like, you know, why do you have to run around? You know, get your gas on a Saturday.
Yeah.
And there's something about that I really love.
Yes.
And there's something there. I don't know what it is just yet in terms of how we'll bring the menu. Maybe we'll make the guests wait a little while when they first arrive. And that can be our ode to Rioja. No,
just slow down.
Just chill out a little. You know, there's something. We went out one night and we did this tapas bar crawl in the little town, and you know, there's not really any tourists where we were,
sure.
And apart from us, and you know, just walking around and eating the tapas and just seeing that way of life, that was also super inspirational.
Yeah.
It was cool.
So, I don't want you to give away any secrets in terms of your menu, but the menu is going to debut at the end of January, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
So we're a little more than a month out from that.
Yep.
Where are you now in the process? How colored in is the picture?
I'd say we're halfway.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I say that every time though, and then when I get to the end, I'm like, yeah, if I look back at halfway, it all got thrown away and nothing ended up getting used. So, you know, it's all just scribbles at the moment, you know, little ideas.
No actual cooking yet.
No.
Okay.
No, we haven't really started that process.
So this is you and Justin sort of dialoguing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where does the wine, how does the wine get brought into this piece?
So the good thing about the trip was, you know, the wine team were able to make a bunch of contacts and get their hands on stuff that they could never normally get. You know, I mean, God, we're so lucky. We drank stuff that was 50 and 60 years old while we were there.
Yeah.
And we might get access to little bits and pieces of that direct from the winery,
sure,
you know, which is where you want to get it from, of course. And, even just getting that access, you know, trying to go and buy stuff at auction in a short amount of time isn't super easy either. So as that wine sort of starts to arrive and we start to flesh out the cellar a little, That'll also be a source of the inspiration. You know, mm-hmm. we'll get to revisit some of that wine and even some of the stuff that we tasted while we were there that we now know we can get. We can start building dishes around. So I think we'll probably do half and half, where we'll, the dish will lead and then the wine will pair to the dish. And then the other half of the menu will probably be the wine leading and then us trying to figure out a dish that works with it.
So this will be sort of over the next several weeks, an ongoing sort of dialogue back and forth.
Yeah.
Between the two, I don't know, departments sounds so corporate, between the two, but those two parts of the restaurant.
Right. Lucky they're not too far away from each other.
Right. But those two, but it'll be a dialogue back and forth until, yeah. I mean, this is another thing. Can you even put words until it seems right, right? Until the yeah. menu feels about right.
Absolutely. We'll sort of eat through it and we'll taste it and we'll refine it and we'll do it again and we'll do it again and we'll do it. We'll keep doing it until we're happy with it. And, you know, sometimes that's with the old mold, you know, settled 3 weeks out before the menu starts. And sometimes it's the night before we kick off, you know, and we're there until ridiculous o'clock, you know, still working away, trying to get stuff that makes sense.
Do you like it like that? Do you like that kind of pressure?
I do, yeah. It took me a while to realize that I did, but I do. I always have.
I asked the question because you obviously have a very busy professional life.
Yep.
You've got a family. Mm-hmm. You travel a lot. I mean, I see your Instagram account. You designed a concept. I mean, this one's going to be quarterly, so it's a little more humane.
Yeah.
But I mean, this to go month to month the way you've done this for 4 years. I mean, I understand that there's passion behind it and that's what you wanted to do, but it just seems like something that was built to create these periodic moments of, I mean, I think of it as I used to do theater in high school and college.
Right.
And, you know, right up, I mean, I remember painting sets the day of the show. I remember, you know, trying to get the blocking right the night before the opening. I mean, I remember that. We all love that pressure.
Right.
And I think there's, my friend Jimmy Bradley, who was my old co-host on this network, you know, he refers to restaurants and theaters, curtain goes up businesses.
Right.
Right. And the people who are drawn to them are drawn to that adrenaline.
You know, I had a couple of years off restaurants.
Yeah.
And which coincided with the time that I met my wife. It's probably why we got married, because if she hadn't met me as a chef, she might not have, she might not have committed.
Right.
But she says that I used to host dinner parties and I'd invite all these people around. And she says, you know, you'd be in the kitchen all day and then 20 minutes before everyone would arrive, I'd start walking around and pulling out chairs and pushing in chairs and telling her this isn't done and that's not done. And she said, I really thought there was something wrong with you. You know, I thought this guy's crazy.
Like OCD or something.
Something just not right. She's like, you wouldn't want any help. And then you'd be just flying around the second before the first doorbell would ring. And she said, you know, once I finally did open a restaurant and she got to see me in that space, she was like, oh, he was always just getting ready for service. Like he missed his restaurants. Yeah. And it was, and I never realized it, but when she said it, I was like, God, it's so true. And I carry that through my life a little bit, not on purpose, by the way, but I'd prefer to run for a flight than be sitting there 45 minutes before the thing takes
that.
Off.
That's perfect. You realize that about yourself.
Yeah. Only recently.
And having recognized it, do you allow yourself that indulgence or do you go, maybe I should, that's one that I should try to, like once you recognize that you did that, do you still run for the flight?
Yeah, I still run for them.
Does it usually work out?
Yeah, I've only missed two.
Really?
Yeah, which isn't a bad track record. I've caught a lot of flights.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I'm not sure what it is. There's something attractive to me about that rush, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
It's adrenaline.
Yeah,
it's isn't that the same thing you get during forget build-up to service.
Right.
In service.
Mm-hmm.
It's that's hours of, I mean, if you're a busy restaurant, ideally,
yep.
You're having an adrenaline rush for hours, no?
It's absolutely.
I mean.
And there's that moment, too, when it starts and you're like, God, am I going to make it? Have I got enough mise en place? Do I have everything that's in its place? Is this guy beside me going to move at the same pace? You know? And as it sort of gets going, you live your life in that moment of we might get through it and it might all fall apart. You know, there's something really good. And I also sort of think that in a restaurant context, if you don't have that feeling,
yeah,
then you're probably not pushing yourself hard enough.
Right.
You probably haven't made it challenging enough because you can always make it easy.
And maybe if you don't have that feeling, it doesn't matter to you as much, right? Like they say people who get butterflies before they perform, it's because they really want to do well.
Right.
That's why you get the butterflies, you know?
I always do a section when I'm at the restaurant. I don't
what
like,
does that mean, do a section?
Well, I work on a station, so I take the grill or I take the garmage or whatever it is that I decide to cook on that night. And if I don't, like but sometimes I arrive there a little later than, you know, if I'm traveling or whatever and I get to the restaurant and service has already started, it's quite disruptive to come and say, I'm going to cook on this station, you go do something else.
Right.
So I don't do that. And I hate being there when I'm not on a station because I feel lost. And I go out to the dining room or people can ask me to come out and I go out and I say hello and I take a photo or whatever it is. And I just, more often than not, I'll leave or I'll go up to the office and I'll work on some ideas for the next menu or whatever because I just don't like wandering around in there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mm. You know, the other thing about the airplane, it's funny. It seems to me that there's this part of our brain that's kind of knows how far you can push things, right?
Right.
Like you said, you've only actually missed two flights. That's not by chance.
Right.
Right. And, you know, you talk about running out of mise en place, but is that really going to happen to most cooks? Probably, you know, maybe you'll get right down to the wire.
Sure.
Or maybe you'll have to, you know, back yourself up a little bit toward the end of the night.
Right.
But it's never going to go that much. I mean, I don't think. Do you know what I'm saying? I think our brains sort of have this sense of how far you can take things.
Sure.
Before you screw up. I don't know.
I think so. I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. And I think you surround yourself with people that are in some ways similar to you and others that are, you know, the opposite. So they're a good balance.
Yeah. So before we wrap up this part of the show, what's how are things at Gwen?
Good. Yeah, we've actually just changed that menu too. We've changed it to be an a la carte menu with a tasty menu option. But when we first launched the restaurant, it was solely you know, a tasty menu restaurant. We did a 10 course and we did a 5 course. And then at one point we said, well, let's do a 3 course because, you know, Hollywood's a bit more casual than what we're probably used to as a group. You know, we've been down in Beverly Hills since we opened. And, you know, I think that it just sort of felt right to give people more options and be in more control of their experience down there. We also have a butcher shop. So to do a tasted menu format and put in a 40-ounce bone-in, you know, 80-day-aged ribeye, it's a little more difficult, you know.
Yeah.
Then, so to offer that as well as a tasting menu was a bit trickier. So anyway, we've changed that to be an a la carte restaurant, which sounds like a small thing. It's just a menu format, but it's actually a big change for a restaurant to figure out what station's picking up what and how it's all going to flow out
as
together.
As opposed to having this sort of synchronized sequence of things that happened over and over throughout the evening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's fun. The guests are loving it and we're there for them. So
great.
Explains the black eyes. A few sleepless nights.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We are obviously talking with Chef Curtis Stone and we will be right back after this break. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a tiny bright. Landing on all fours, feel like a cat who's ready for a wild night. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
And we are back talking with Chef Curtis Stone. Before we pick up our conversation, I do just want to remind everybody, as I do every week, if you'd like to subscribe to Andrew Talks to Chefs, you can do that on iTunes or Stitcher. We have one more episode this season that will be with Chef Richard Blaze, and that debuts this Wednesday. And then we're going to go away for a few weeks, and I don't want everyone to forget about us. So the easiest thing is to subscribe to the show. And then sometime about this time in January, our interview with Missy Robbins of Lilia Restaurant will drop into your feed, and it'll be like we never went away. I think that would be a good idea. Don't you think that'd be good, Chef?
I think it's a good idea, and I love Missy. She'll be a very interesting
interview. Yeah, she's our first guest of 2018.
No, that's cool.
All right, so subscribe, and you won't miss out on that, and you won't miss out on Richard Blaze later this week. Okay, with that, Curtis, we are here at the holiday season.
Yep.
It is the giving season.
Yes.
There is a program that you have, well, several programs. There's one program, an umbrella program that you have in your organization, and through that program, you've been involved with two groups, and it's about to be three. Mm-hmm. And I thought it'd be nice at this time of year to talk about that. Because it's really interesting to me how it ties into the profession, but also your whole sort of philosophy of this is interesting to me. Why don't you just tell me about the evolution of this part of your company?
So it's how we give, right, yep, as a company, and we've actually called it Commit to One. What that means is at the beginning of our sort of business, we were asked a lot of people reach out to restaurants and say, can you donate dinners at the restaurant, or can you come and cook in someone's home, or auction yourself off, or and we would try and give as much as we could, you know, but you can imagine you end up feeling in some ways like you give a lot and not necessarily achieve very much.
Yeah. And the volume, because I've seen it firsthand when I collaborate with people on their books, right?
Yeah.
And I'm at the restaurant for a span of hours. Maybe every other time I'm there, the reservationist will come over, there's a phone call, and I'm not putting any of it down. All these people are trying to raise money for important things.
Right.
But it does start to feel like an onslaught to you, probably. I mean, my fellow New Yorkers, it's like when you walk around the city and people in need are constantly asking you for money.
Right.
I mean, it's that sort of frequency.
It is. It really is.
And it starts to, I think, make chefs actually feel bad. You don't want to say no. I mean, it's in chef's nature to say yes, right?
Right. Yep.
So, sorry to interrupt, but I do think the psychology does start to become really overwhelming to you guys.
Yeah, it is. It's a challenge because you want to do good things and you want to help people
out.
But, you know, our industry is also pretty scrappy. It's not like we make a fortune in the restaurant
business. The profit margins are small.
Small, very small. You've got to be careful that you're making wise decisions and a good shepherd of your company and its employees.
Sure.
So anyway, we got to talking and Gita came up with an idea of doing a thing called Commit to One, which is we choose one charity for a 12-month period.
Yes.
And we commit all of our charitable resources to them. So we sit down with them the year prior and say, what's important to you and how could we help? And this is what we can give.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain number of days of my time. There's the access to the restaurant on certain times. There's access to the dining room and tables to give away. There's PR opportunities.
This is like the package that you guys offer to whoever your partner will be for a year.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So in year one, we worked with the Young Farmers Association.
Okay.
And what they did is we sat down with them and we came up with some ideas. We did a series of guest chef dinners and fundraising was important to them. So we raised some money and
this was on the, all of that. And some of that was on the, was it some of it on the road or people came to, you did something with Mike Anthony that year.
Yeah. Mike came to,
he came to you.
To LA and
okay.
did a dinner with us.
Yeah.
Dominique Krenn came down to LA.
Right.
Mike Ladder came down.
Amazing.
Wiley Dufresne, you know, great chefs.
Yeah.
And, you know, spreading that word of how these young independent farmers have access to land less than they used to. They have debts more than they used to. They have to, you know, compete with these huge factory farms that make it very difficult for them to compete on a technological background.
Yeah.
You know, education's more important to farmers than it ever was.
Sure.
So if you want to be a small independent farmer, it's very, very difficult to enter that industry. And it's even, you know, a topic that people don't talk about very often and don't know much about. So our goal was to sort of work with them for 12 months. And we did that and had a great relationship with them. And this year we've been working with a company called Chrysalis.
Yeah.
which is a an organization in LA that are in the business of giving out second chances. So they literally have
it's a great phrase. Yeah,
it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. They change people's lives through jobs, I think, is their strapline. And what they do is they open their doors to anyone. If you're straight out of prison or if you're homeless or down on your luck in whatever way, you can walk through their doors and they'll help you get job ready. And then try and help you get placed and sort of, like they say, change your life through a job.
Yeah.
So we'd employed one of their candidates a few years ago, four years ago actually, when we first opened Maud. And so we had a good relationship with them and we thought they'd be a great organization to commit our efforts to in that 1 year. And we've spent 12 months really sort of working with them as a charitable partner. I mean, we've worked with them as a client relationship for 4 years, and we've employed maybe 30 of those guys over those 4 years that have come in and filled all sorts of positions, from dishwashers to glass polishers to runners in the dining room, you know, prep cooks, which has been a pretty rewarding experience. And in fact,
for you guys,
really rewarding. Yeah, our staff retention of our Chrysalis employees is 2-to-1. Of what our normal employees is.
Is that, do you think, because they are, I mean, this would, I'm asking you to say an immodest thing, but do you think that's because they're grateful for the chance that you guys gave them? Do you think that's why they stay there?
Yep.
Instead of just looking for, oh, I can make a buck more an hour over here, or it's time for me to go change, you know, get a different experience somewhere and see a different chef's food, or I would imagine these people would be less inclined to be as mercenary in their decision-making.
The thing that's really important to them, actually, and I'm generalizing because they're all different.
Sure.
For the most part, and a lot of the guys that we've employed are pretty fresh out of jail.
Yeah.
And the thing that seems most important to them is stability. Mm. And they really respect and like a system. And they like stability. And it's interesting. In the business, we take a lot of things for granted, you know. Yeah. And then these guys come in and maybe they work as a dishwasher and we give them a T-shirt to wear and we give them a family meal each day. And they're the first guys to come and thank us for dinner because to them it means a lot, you know, and they fill themselves up nice big plates and, you know.
Well, these guys were having a different kind of family meal not long ago.
That's right.
You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny. You're watching guys that have only worked in 2- and 3-star Michelin restaurants their whole life standing next to guys that were just in prison a few months ago and watching that relationship build and grow and, you know, informing your team about their situation makes them a lot more understanding and they sort of go out of their way to make them feel special. And it's been a really, really cool relationship. You know, the stories, we could talk for hours about the individual stories that we've come across. And the truth is a lot of these guys just get a very different start in life than what most people get. And a lot of them are in foster care from when they're abandoned by their parents and for whatever reason in foster care. They're dealing drugs or manufacturing drugs in some cases by the time they're 13.
Yeah.
You know, and it's you sort of get a different window into life and you're like, God, you really had no chance. And the fact that you've come through it and you've matured in some kind of fashion to say, okay, I'm going to turn my life around and I'm actually going to go and hold down a job. And we've had some of these guys for 4 years. Some of them have the keys to our restaurants and open and close the place, you know, and it's really rewarding.
I have to just ask this question because having interviewed the number of chefs I've interviewed, I mean, hundreds of chefs, their life story, right?
Yeah.
When you talk about getting a bad start in life, the way you just did, okay, up into the moment of committing crime, and in some people, to be totally honest, up into the moment of getting caught and convicted of committing crime, you're describing a lot of cooks.
Yeah.
And I'm not being cute. I mean, I'm really not. You're describing a lot of people who end up in kitchens.
Yep.
And it seems to me, whenever I hear about programs similar to Chrysalis, and when I hear about Chrysalis from you, these are people who, if they had maybe found a kitchen in their teenage years, might have found a career, might have found a profession, might have found a place where they felt comfortable.
Yep.
No?
Absolutely. You're absolutely
right.
And
I don't, some people hearing this who don't know cooks or haven't spent times around the cook population, I'm really not being cute about it. A lot of people who end up in kitchens. Tons of people use the word misfit to describe themselves as kids.
Right.
There's tons of people in kitchens who were the pot dealer in their high school. There just are. You don't have to say anything about that.
No, you're absolutely right.
It's just true.
Right.
It's just true. That's who a lot of – and the kitchen saves them.
We've joked about it before and said it's a glorified juvenile detention center because the truth is that there's a lot of youth, you know, in kitchens. There's a lot of kids, and there's a lot of kids that – you're right. They fell out of school or they didn't make it
they
to college.
They don't fit in anywhere else.
Right.
But they fit in a kitchen.
Yep.
It suits them.
That's very true. So there's a real camaraderie there between the regular crew
the question
and
I was
the Chrysalis crew.
There is, yes.
There really is, And I mean,
does it feel more natural than you think people might have assumed when you said you were signing on to this program?
For sure. Yeah. And I think, you know, the thing that people also assume is, you know, there's this like fear around someone that's done something wrong.
Yes.
And I think if you really look yourself in the mirror and ask yourself if you've ever done anything wrong, and if your answer's no, then you're a pretty special person. You know, I think most of us at certain times in our life have done things we've regretted or done things we shouldn't have or been lucky to get away with and not be punished for. And, you know, these guys just had a different path and they've made the decision to change that, and you know they come to work, and in many, many ways they're our most reliable, most hardworking staff members. It's really crazy, you know. So
it's amazing.
It's been a good relationship with Chrysalis because we've carried on employing their team. I think we've got maybe a dozen of them on our books right now. And we've also been able to sort of shine a bit of a spotlight on it. I've been able to share my story with the restaurant business. We had a lunch out in LA this year, and I invited a bunch of industry leaders, restaurateurs and chefs, and told them my story and meet the guys, and the guys cooked them lunch, and we had a lunch in there at Gwen, and they sort of walked around and mingled with these. You know, it's funny. You see Mary Sue Milliken and, you know, these great chefs sitting around chatting to some of my guys that work in the back. And as a result, a lot of the industry has sort of woken up and had a go at it too. I've got a lot of different chefs that have reached out and got the details and hired their first Chrysalis employee. And with the way that our business moves, because, you know, when I sat down with Chrysalis, I said, well, what's important? And they're like, to find people like you that actually give them a job. You know, that's the hard part. Because if you've got whatever sort of criminal convictions or – imagine going for a job interview and them saying, so where do you live? And you say, well, I don't have a home right now. I'm homeless. Right. You're not going to give that guy a job under any other circumstance. Yeah. But if you just open your mind to it a little bit and say, all right, well, you know, I'm going to set out a really clear set of rules, and you've got to be very direct and be like, this is the deal. If you don't come back, if you're late, it's a 3 strikes and you're out policy, you know, whatever your deal is. And they respond to it really, really well.
To the structure.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is another thing I think about young cooks. There's so many people who come into kitchens, I feel like, who were just craving that structure.
Right. And to your point before, they're also not coming to you saying, when can I be the assistant manager in 3 months' time?
Right.
Which is you know, a bit more consistent with someone that comes straight out of culinary
college. Can I be interviewed when that camera crew comes through later today?
Right.
Yeah. This could be my big break.
Yep. No, they don't want to be interviewed. That's for sure.
So we're at the end of the year here. Who's the next commit to one? Who's the next one?
It's Adopt Together, which is a charity that was founded by this crazily inspirational guy, Hank Fortimer. He came from a family that was really interesting. His mother used to say to the people down there at the adoption place, you know, just give me the kids that no one else will take. And Hank, you know, he grew up with 20 or 30 brothers and sisters from all walks of life, and, you know, some were machines that kept them alive, and others were – it was a really, really fascinating story. And he goes on to talk to you about the foster care system and how, you know, broken that is in many ways. And, you know, when you look at American prisons today, I think 70%, more than 70% of the American prison system – aged out of the foster care system.
Wow.
And when you think about that, you think about these kids that come into the world without a home and they continually get told, we don't want you in this home either. And they get sent to another home and sent to another home. And there's a variety of reasons that it's a challenge. And adoption is a very different alternative, I think. You know, when you're adopted into a family, you're taken into a family and you've got people to rely on and to trust and
yes.
to be a part of. And so what they do with Adopt Together, it's a crowdfunding organization, really, is they help people cut through all the red tape. It costs like $40,000 to adopt someone on average, I think.
Isn't that crazy?
Isn't it ridiculous?
Yeah. It ought to be free.
It should be free. Yeah. But you know that's the way of the world, and we have somewhere close to 20 million more than 20 million orphans in the world right now, and a lot of families that want to adopt, but they can't necessarily afford it.
Yeah.
So we want to put a real spotlight on that, because while it's amazing helping the guys out at Chrysalis, Chrysalis's real goal is to have no one walk through their doors. You know, they'd love to be out of business because no one needed them. But at the moment they do, and maybe this is a way of getting to people a little bit earlier in their life. And, so that's sort of where we're going to channel our energy next year.
That's great. You just talked about all these chefs who came to this lunch that you did to promote Chrysalis.
Yeah.
Are you getting any traction with this sort of approach to giving? In other words, is this a conversation that you find yourself having with fellow chefs and restaurateurs, this commit to one notion? Is it something people are interested in? Is it something you find yourself trying to quote unquote sell to other people? It seems like a very evolved way of looking at how to use the limited resources that you guys have to offer.
You know, we haven't spoken about it a lot, to be honest, and it's something I think we should speak about more, because I'm sure there's other people out there in the same positions we were that were feeling like they were spinning their tires a little bit and not necessarily and it's not like you need to sign up to some special club. It's just, you know, if you decide to do it, then that's sort of an interesting way to go about it.
Right.
The philanthropic conversation has become a lot more important for us, I think, as a company. And, you know, watching what it's done for us internally, I think it's really beneficial. You know, there's some real pride in the team when they get to be a part of something like that, and they get to see that they are actually helping others. And they're, you know, the beautiful thing about it is you come into it thinking, I'm going to help others, and in actual fact, it enriches your life in some way. And, you know, I've gotten so much out of it in the last couple of years that it's something that I'm more bullish to keep doing more of.
I mean, it's fascinating to me because I used to be a publicist, and, I did have this thought sometimes when people would be going to do events, which is, I mean, there was a time that was all chefs did, right? Probably 30 years ago, at least in the United States, was the tasting benefit, right? With you, and these still happen all the time. And I'm not putting them down, but I did at one point kind of just in my head do some rough math. And I thought, well, you know, by the time you take your crew out of your restaurant, donate the product, the time it takes to prep it, the transportation, you probably could have just written a check to the charity.
Right.
And the thing nobody really wants to say, I think, is that, you know, a lot of, shouldn't even say it, but I'll say it. But, you know, a lot of it is PR driven, some of that stuff.
Yeah.
I do think what you guys are doing is really fascinating. And I think it's very, the word I use is evolved. I think it's, and what your team gets out of it, and what you personally, I mean, people can't see your face as we're talking here, but you're clearly derived something very personal from this.
You know, I think it's about getting your hands dirty. And that's what was important to us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think what happened, someone comes to you and it sounds like a good idea, it sounds like a great charity, and it sounds amazing, and they ask you for a table for six in the restaurant. Now, that's got a value, you know, depending on what you – it's pretty easy to make the connection. Let's say your check average is $200 and you give away a table of six. That costs you $1,200 because that otherwise would have been sat and you would have gotten paid for it. So you're writing a check for $1,200 by saying, yes, I'll give you the table. Now, does it turn into $1,200 for that charity? And does that charity use it well? You have no idea whether that's the case or not.
Right.
Did they pay for the fundraiser, or was the fundraiser put on by somebody?
Right.
I think every charity does it differently.
Yes.
But there's never really incredible clarity around it. And I think, you know, there's a part of just being a good part of your community that's really important too. And that's sort of where we saw it as important for us. I mean, we're in Hollywood. Gwen, our restaurant, is in Hollywood. Hollywood has a homeless problem.
Yes. There's
no bars about it. Absolutely. You know, we deal with homelessness on a day-to-day basis, mm-hmm. and not in a positive way. You know, we have people sometimes try and walk in the restaurant.
Yeah, I've seen it.
We don't want them in the restaurant with our guests, or sleeping on the street, you know, not far from the dining room, and that's not pleasant either. So, you know, I think you can either be a bystander and complain about it, or you can say, well, what can we actually do to try and fix it? You know, and that's sort of something that we've tried to contribute in some way.
I think it's great. I have to say, sitting here, I'm going to have reason to be in Los Angeles early in the new year, and two of the very best meals I had last year, not just in LA, but in the country, were Gwen and Maude. So I can't wait I don't know if I'll order a la carte. I may still do a tasty menu, but I can't wait to come back there, and I cannot wait to hopefully get in for the Rioja dinner.
Well, that's a compliment. I know how much you eat out, so that's a big compliment. Thank you very much.
Curtis, it's great to see you. Thank you for making time on. I know this is a really quick trip, to see us, you know, right off the plane, before you've even gotten a cup of coffee or a glass of something. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
No worries at all. Nice
to
see you.
And Merry Christmas.
You too.
All the best for next year.
Thanks, mate.
Happy holidays. And that's our show. A huge thank you to Curtis Stone for wedging us in to a very short visit to New York City. Curtis, thank you so much for making the time. I've, as you know, wanted to have you on forever and had been badgering Gita to get you on. So I was thrilled that you were able to do it on this trip. David Tatasciore, our engineer, thanks as always for splicing these things together. And to my wife, Caitlin Friedman, for joining me for the introduction to the show. Thank you, Caitlin. I appreciate it. This always seems to happen at the least opportune time. So thanks for getting this one in as well. And for anyone who'd like to follow the show, I'd encourage you to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. I would also personally love and appreciate it if you left us a rating or especially a review on iTunes. It really does help people find the show, and if you took a minute to do that, we'd be forever grateful. You can also follow the show and keep current that way on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. The handle is @ChefPodcast. That's @ChefPodcast. And you can follow me personally on Twitter and Instagram @ToklandAndrew, TOQUELAND, Andrew. And again, that's Twitter and Instagram. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us later this week for our last episode of the season with Chef Richard Blaze. See you soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs.